We resumed our fitness plan today. That's why we're all breathing hard. We literally raced to get here. We're so anxious to get here. Okay, today is Military Day. We will start with opening a public hearing on House Bill 2092. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2092A establishes that a member of the armed forces who is in active military service and has joint custody of a child may delegate to his or her spouse the powers regarding the care, custody, or property of the child. The bill clarifies that delegation is effective during the active service plus an extra 30 days unless the court finds that delegation is not in the best interest of the child.
General Caldwell, we have honored with your presence today. Senator Walker, did you have
a question? Yeah, both Senator Przanski and I think have the same question. I was just reading
in the newspaper
an article about parents who are losing custody because they're gone for a long period of time, and I'm hoping if this bill doesn't address that, we can do something about it, General Caldwell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director at the Oregon Military Department, and this bill will assist in some of that. In the case that I think you're talking about was the female soldier from Missouri, or
three or four examples.
Right. And I think what we have found with these deployments is that we have situations that occur that are unique to, we've never thought of these things before. This particular bill, what it does is it tries to rectify some of the issues that occur, particularly when parents are in a divorce status where the child is being, shared custody, joint custody. We've had situations where soldiers would be deployed for 18 months, get maybe 1 2-week break in that 18 months to come home and reunite. During that period, they've, perhaps have a second family now with stepchildren and a stepmother or stepfather, and that child has been kept away from that new family during that period until the father or the mother comes back for that 2-week period. And therefore, they have absolutely no visibility, no communication, no interaction, and it becomes extremely difficult on the child, the family apparatus, the whole shebang. So that's what this bill set out to rectify, is to make sure that communication, those bonds are maintained during these long deployments. And so that was our initial objective. I think the article that you're speaking of and some of the news that's come out has been similar to that, but in a little different twist, perhaps. But it is a custody issue. It still falls in that same genre. The soldier obviously can't come back at a moment's notice. They're scheduled back, and they're usually 2 weeks leave during that 18-month deployment. And so without that interconnectivity between in some cases the grandparents, some cases the new parents, the stepmother, the stepchildren, it really makes this a dysfunctional unit when the soldier comes home, and reintegrating them back together becomes extremely difficult. Ultimately, the judge has the courts have the right to make the judgment based on the evidence that both parties may present, and or parents, grandparents, or new families. So I think that this leads us halfway there, but certainly the courts have the final say.
And then there's nothing mandatory in this, so that if the other parent doesn't want, or if the step parent, in effect, doesn't want to continue this, there's nothing to force them to. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, basically what the bill says that if you have those rights as you're departing, then you can assign those rights to your new spouse or perhaps a grandparent or something to that effect. Now, if somebody objects to that, of course, the courts will make that determination. They have the final say. But it gives this certainly that departing spouse gives them an opportunity to state their wishes before they leave. And ultimately, if there's a conflict, then the judge is going to have to make that call.
Senator Walker?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. General Caldwell, this doesn't get to the issue that has been occurring in other states, because this is in a situation where you have joint custody.
Correct.
I think in several of those cases, did I read that in the Oregonian or the Register Guard? you know, the registered guard, they had sole custody, and then, or even if there wasn't sole custody, they had joint, and then they went to live with the other parent. When they got back, the judge says, well, you know, they've been with this parent so long, you lose. And that's so unfair. And it took this one woman like $25,000 to go through all these legal hoops to get her child back.
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, what we require is that every single parent has a family care plan for their dependent children. And they either have that plan or they can't be deployed. There are situations where we've had single parents who didn't have a workable plan, and so therefore those people were pulled off the deployment and other people were put in their place. And then when we've done that here in Oregon, in the case you're talking about, it was a single mom who didn't, I think, had full custody of the child, but had made a family care plan that gave, in case of deployment, back to her former spouse. Upon return after this 18-month deployment, the courts held that, and indeed, the child was doing better with the former spouse and not the soldier, and therefore they would not let her have her rights back. I guess with this, like I said, goes a partial step. If in that situation they can assign these rights to maybe she could have assigned them to her parent or her new spouse, which I don't know that she has one. The article I read didn't really make that clear. And therefore, that bonding would still be happening even though she's departed. I think in her case, the right decision would have been to do like we have done, which is, you know, again, when people have a very weak or not a complete plan, we just don't deploy them. We find somebody to take their place. And we've done that in many occasions because of similar issues.
General Caldwell, you keep mentioning the parent or the grandparent, but I don't see any reference to this delegation authority applying to grandparents. All I see is the spouse of the service member parent.
Madam Chair, I guess I was referring up into the current law, which basically says a parent or guardian of a minor child, which it refers to in Section 1. And I was assuming, and again, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm sure one of the...
I see. So what you're saying is if the grandparent is a guardian and is...
Yes, ma'am.
...is deployed...
Well, it talks about, except as provided in this section, a parent or a guardian of a minor of an incapacitated person, but then it refers down to it later in Section 1 if it meets those requirements. So when we set out to do this, when we wrote this back last fall, we were trying to solve the single issue, not the one that we're talking about today. The single issue we were trying to solve was this new marriage, you know, 22nd century family where you have yours, mine, and ours kind of situation, which would happen to us in one of our soldiers' case. And so that's what we set out to solve. This may not get there. You may be absolutely right.
Would there be any problem with an amendment that just said that during the period of deployment, the custody arrangement would remain static, would not change because of the deployment?
We would certainly not be opposed to that, no. And I think this speaks to what Senator Walker is trying to get at, which is the difficulty that we saw in this news, in the latest news of a single mother, in her case, with no new nuclear family or whatever we call ourselves today, and probably could have assigned to a parent, a grandparent in the child's case, and made it work.
So if you had those two provisions, if you had this one that allows them to delegate the powers and also a fallback that their custody arrangements won't be in jeopardy simply because of the deployment, that would make a stronger bill, it would seem to me.
Madam Chair, I would agree. The only concern I would have is do we have enough time to push it through both houses to get it done? And
do.
It might be a situation where we want to get this bite of the apple and come back for another bite.
You know, Senator Walker is so speedy on these things. Senator Walker, would you be willing to take this on and do us an amendment in consultation with General Caldwell?
Madam Chair, I certainly would, and I see Sybil Hebb just sort of quivering out there, so I don't know if she's disagreeing with what we're trying to do. I'd like to hear from her if we might.
Okay. Sybil, would you like to come up and comment on this?
Thank you, Sybil.
Flailing blindly in the dark here.
I was quivering, I admit it. I apologize. Thank you, Sybil Hebb, for the record with the Oregon Law Center. And I appreciate the concerns that have been expressed. And the only sort of caveat or other concern that I would want to make sure the committee was aware of was that in Oregon, as in many states, the overall standard that guides decisions and determinations with respect to custody is the best interests of the child. And I think that that is the right public policy overall consideration to make, and that we wouldn't want to create any mandatory requirements that would override that consideration. So we just want that to be in the backdrop. Of course, I wouldn't think that per se a person's deployment or service in the military should have any impact on that decision, but the facts and specific scenarios need to be considered. So the situation of the child and the best interest of the child needs to be the overarching principle. And the only other consideration I would add to the committee is that there is the Service Members Relief Act. Do I have that name
right? Yeah, Sarah.
Which provides that a person who is in the active military service cannot have a default action taken against him or her. And so that provides some staying of procedures. You'll hear more about that.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah,
this article, Sybil, that we had in the Register Garden, it was over the weekend because I saw it too, actually talked about whether there was relief there. But it seems to be controlling is what is in the best interest of the child, and that over it preempts is what they have saying that the different courts have come to, that they think that the test for the child is a higher standard or has priority over the Relief Act.
And Madam Chair, and I would agree with Senator Przanski. I'm looking up the Register Guard article right now, but I just have to strongly disagree in this case. I just think it's so unfair. These people are over there fighting some stinking war they don't even want to be in. You know, they're part of the Guard. They have to do what they're called up to do. But the federal government is keeping them longer than they expect to, 18 months, way longer than they're supposed to be. And they're left without any recourse. And the Soldiers and Sailors Relief Act has not assisted them in any way. And when this woman got back, her kid wasn't returned to her because the judge decided it was in the best interest of the child to leave the child with the parent. And that's not right. I mean, I have to argue with you about that one.
Senator Przanski.
I'd like to just ask Sybil if she would consider, I mean, I think what we're wanting to do is not have these deployments actually cause or be the sole basis for reassigning the custodial position of the parent with the child. And I'm wondering if we added some type of an amendment that says that just because they've been deployed, that cannot be the sole basis for making that decision. That would still give the court, I think, the flexibility to take care of the best interest of the child, but where we wouldn't have, as soon as mom or dad is deployed, this, well, I'm going to go for it while they can't really defend themselves.
And Senator Przanski, Senator Walker, and members of the committee, I'd be happy to work on something like that. And I agree that the per se deployment should never be grounds one way or the other. But I do think that they need to be considered in conjunction, and that, you know, that we need to have that backdrop for consideration. So I'd be happy to look at this
committee
further.
Our counsel just pointed out our relating clause here, which is relating to delegation of parental powers. This is a worthy issue, but it's pretty clear it won't be an appropriate issue for this bill. So we probably, if we want to pursue that, we'll no. Delegation of parental powers.
Oh,
fine.
Another relating clause.
I mean, why do we think that that wouldn't be broad enough to include? Because they're talking about parental powers. We're talking about
delegation. It's delegation of parental powers. And if it were parental powers, we would definitely be able to do it. But it's an interesting discussion. It may not be doable this time, because I suspect it is a lot more complicated, because we wouldn't want to, for example, if there were a scenario where someone came back from Iraq, they'd been gone for 2 years, and they had severe mental health issues, that would be a totally different scenario.
That's why it wouldn't be based on the sole basis of the deployment, but other factors would be taken in.
Exactly, but to get that to get the right balance there would be a pretty complicated thing. I welcome efforts to try that and find a relating clause.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I will, and I did locate the article. It was published on Sunday. It was an AP story, and it was Lieutenant Eva Crouch from Kentucky National Guard. And after the divorce, she raised her daughter for 6 years following the divorce, and a year and a half later after her deployment was up, she pulled into her driveway wanting her daughter home, dialed her ex, said she'd be there to pick her daughter up, and he said, not without a court order, you won't. And that's when, within a month, a judge decided that the child should stay with the dad, saying it was in the best interest of the child. And it took her several months and $25,000 later to get her child back. And it says here, the Service Members Civil Relief Act, which is what it's called now, it did not assist her. So I'll get a little work group together. General Caldwell, I promise you we're not going to lose this bill. I promise you that, but let me work with it a little bit, see what we can do, and if I can't do it in this bill or find a bill with a relating clause, then we'll just have to do it some other way, and we'll let this one go through. But if the chair's willing, I'm willing to take it on.
Well, I appreciate that, and I invite Senator Przanski to participate as well. But today I want to send this bill along because of our deadline.
Just so the committee knows, there's another service member bill that we're about to hear in about 2 seconds, which is relating to stays of proceedings.
Okay.
That might be a little bit broader, but.
And Sybil, as long as we have you up here, are you fine with the bill as it is now?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Close the work session on House Bill 2092. Close public hearing on House Bill 2092. Open a work session on House Bill 2092. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2092 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2092 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation as A engrossed. Any discussion?
I'll do it. I understand the relating clause problem, and I'll try to take care of it.
Yeah, we wouldn't want to limit you in any way, Senator Walker.
Trust me, Madam Chair, if there's a rock to turn over, I will turn it over.
And we count on you. Any objection? So ordered. Maybe you'd like to carry this, Senator Walker.
Okay, I can.
Okie dokie, now we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2093. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Under ORS 399.238, members of the Oregon National Guard who are called into active federal service may apply to a court for a stay of a civil proceeding or for relief from any obligation or liability incurred before the active service began. House Bill 2093A would allow members of the armed forces to request a stay of administrative proceedings or relief from any obligation or liability awarded in an administrative proceeding under certain circumstances. The bill would extend the benefits of the Act to the Oregon National Guard members who are called into active state duty as well.
Okay, General Caldwell, you didn't even leave.
Madam Chair, I was just trying to save some motion here and get you onto your agenda. Appreciate the opportunity again for the record, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Military Department. This bill is again part of the newfound knowledge that we're learning as we deploy not only internationally but all over the world, but also here in the United States. During Operation Katrina, when we were summoned to send troops down to Louisiana, we initially mobilized our troops under state active duty. That was the only method we had to do that, which puts them under the control of the governor and at the cost of the governor. And you probably all read about the repayment issues that we went through trying to get FEMA to pay us back and that sort of thing. About 9-10 days into the operation, the federal government stepped up and said, well, we're going to put these folks, all these guardsmen, under Title 32, which is a U.S. code, and pay the bill. Well, that means that they're under the control of the governor, but they're paid for by the federal government. In some cases, when you're under federal service, the Uniform Services Relief Act does apply and takes care of any administrative or court proceedings, but not in the case of state active duty. in the case of state active duty, where you're sent out for those 9 days, we had situations where people were under administrative courts for one reason or another, had cases pending, and because they couldn't show up during that scheduled date because we'd sent them to Louisiana, they were basically didn't get their day in court, and they lost their opportunity. So we had, in 2005 or 2003, I can't remember, we had fixed what we thought was the Oregon statutory language under the criminal acts to make sure that when these people are deployed outside the state under state active duty or any title for that matter, federal or state, that they would not be held, not lose their opportunities. However, we didn't deal with the civil courts, and this bill basically puts the same language in for civil courts. So if you have a civil proceeding, tax court, something of that nature, then at least you do not lose your opportunity because you're serving. And that's pretty much what this bill does.
Okay. Are there any questions from the committee? Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2093 and keep it on our agenda for a little later today while Senator Walker makes a call to legislative council to see how much can go in this bill.
Okay, I'll wait. I had another meeting in the governor's office that I was going to run to, but can I have the administrator
leave? I mean, you're
just you don't need to be. The issue here is whether we hold on to this bill,
right.
to try to work out something on it.
And
if we do that, it will be a set time period. We'll set it for next week, and things will either happen or not.
Sounds good.
The alternative is we'll just send it through, so I don't think you'll be needed.
I'll leave my card with the administrator in case you do need me.
Senator,
I mean, looking at the relating clause, I don't think it's going to do what Senator Walker and I were wanting to do because it relates to stays of proceedings.
Right. Yeah. I don't think it's going to do it either, but so Senator Walker would... Senator Walker would like a
thank
chance
you.
To check it with legislative council. So thank you very much. The hearing is closed on House Bill 2093. We're going to go a little out of order here because we have several people signed up. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2826. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2826A establishes that a corporation may adopt a provision in its Articles of Incorporation that authorizes or directs the corporation to conduct its business in an environmentally and socially responsible manner.
And we have my constituent, Mr. Roy, with us today. Welcome. And Andrew Morrow and Jeff Wilson, I presume. Okay, go ahead in whatever order you'd like.
Okay, Senator Burdick and committee, I'm Dick Roy, and by background, I was a corporate lawyer at Stoll Reeves for 23 years, and then I've worked the past 14 years in the sustainability movement, working with individuals, businesses, and some public agencies in voluntary practices that might be pursued to reduce impact on the earth. That's kind of been the role that I played. Protocol-wise, do you want to hear who these folks are, too? Because they may...
You finish, and as they speak, they will introduce themselves for the record.
The Oregon Business Corporation Act has a provision that deals with the Articles of Incorporation, and Articles of Incorporation are kind of the primary governing document for the work of a corporation. This House bill adds to that section an allowance for the Articles of Incorporation to include a provision that the corporation shall take into account or shall operate in a manner that's environmentally and socially responsible. Now, this is consistent with the concept of sustainability, which is being adopted by a lot of corporations now, and that is that they're pursuing the triple bottom line, and that would be the economic side, the environmental side, and the social side. So it's an allowance in the statute itself for that. Now, that could be done now, and kind of the policy reasons I would say for this are the first thing, and I have testimony there that covers these three points, which are fairly simple, is the articles simply state an option and make it clear that the board of directors and the shareholders together can adopt this provision for the articles of incorporation. So this either has to be in the articles at the outset or would require a recommendation by the board and approval of the shareholders. So it's an optional provision for those that would choose it. The second thing is there is a common misunderstanding that business corporations should be operated only for profit. And as you can see from a lot of things going on today, is there are all sorts of goals that corporations have other than strictly the bottom line in an economic sense. Jeff can talk about the corporation that he's general counsel for now and some of the things that it's doing. Nike, a well-known corporation here, is doing a lot of things both on the social and environmental side by choice. If you look at the website for Dow Chemical, you can see that its entire framework for every operation now is the triple bottom line. And then the final thing is this is, we have had since Governor Kitzhaber, both statutory and by executive order, a statewide goal of sustainability. The business summit this year.
Kulongoski.
Or excuse me, yeah. Well, Kitzhaber was the first he had the first executive order on this topic. The business summit this year chose sustainability as a primary theme, and Oregon is kind of recognized in this area. So it's a reflection of both a statewide policy of the state and also of the business community generally. And with that brief introduction, would you like to go on to the others?
We will, and I want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. It's a very simple bill, but it's elegant and creative. So
okay.
And we can move on, unless there are questions of Mr. Roy. Okay.
My name is Jeff Wolfstone. I'm a practicing lawyer with Lane Powell in Portland. I'm also serving as general counsel for an outdoor apparel company, fairly new in Portland, called NAU, N-A-U. Chair Burdick and members of the committee, just wanted to make a couple of points. I think Dick has laid out the groundwork quite well. One, we think it's a very modest proposal, and it's an opt-in, as Dick has mentioned, so a company is not obligated to follow any particular rule, and they can also write their own rules. They do not have to follow the language of the statute. They can divine their own interpretation of it. In characterizing the bill also, I would say that it's not a radical change from current practice. As Dick was mentioning a moment ago, many companies have, without putting something in their articles, have adopted practices that would, we think, be consistent with the spirit of this proposal. And finally, I would say that checks and balances exist so that in the marketplace there will be limits on how far a company would go relative to the adoption of such a provision. And we think that that will be a measure of restraint, and if people were concerned about, you know, where this might lead. So I just commend to you the materials we provided. I've provided Jim Kennedy's written testimony. He unfortunately cannot be here today. He also appeared before the House committee and updated his testimony, and it's included in the materials you've received. And then second, I provided some written materials on the company NAU as an example of what a new company might do or what an existing company might choose to opt into. And I would say that's probably toward the outer edge. I think many companies, if they were to do this, would pick something a little more modest. So with that, we thank you for your time and be pleased to respond to any questions.
Are there questions from the committee? Okay. Can you be very brief?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Andy Morrow. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland. I'm here appearing because of my personal interest. I'm just here to answer questions. So if there are any from the committee, I'm happy to do that.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer.
The way I read current law, corporations can already do this if they want. I'm looking at A and B under sub C. Sub 2, the corporations already, they can have provisions regarding the purpose or purposes for which the corporation is organized and managing the business and regulation affairs of the corporation. And even the next one, defining and regulating the powers of the corporation's board of directors and shareholders. You don't need a bill to do this.
We've got three lawyers here. Anybody want to respond to that?
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, the purpose of this bill is actually to bring attention to the fact that people can do this, and in the process provide some support for directors who would choose to do so under the business judgment rule. Jim Kennedy's testimony kind of focuses on that. But you are correct that somebody could adopt this under present law.
And so why do you feel that you need the bill? I think that's what Senator Beyer was asking.
I'll take a run with that. The concept is that the business judgment rule, which is the rule under which courts review the judgments of directors, is a standard that doesn't have clear boundaries on it. We're not attempting to change the business judgment rule, but we're trying to give companies the right to create a poll star by which the board can set the rules and encourage them to consider setting the rules for where they might draw lines on social responsibility and environmental responsibility in their conduct. So it's really something that they could then refer back to if challenged in their behavior, and they can point to the fact that the statute has expressly acknowledge that.
But do you anticipate challenges if they were to do this and this were not in the statute?
We think it would give a little extra comfort to boards if challenged.
Okay. Any follow-up?
Well, I guess I'd just point out that it doesn't matter if the boards are going outside what they think the shareholders think they should be doing. They're going to boot them with whether this is in the statute or not. I mean, they may not be able to, you know, deal with the court, but they can certainly remove them from the board of directors if the shareholders don't like what the corporation is doing, and this isn't going to change that.
Yeah, I disagree here on that point.
Yeah, I don't have any disagreement with that either. I think the one thing that is new now and which this reflects is the triple bottom line now is an operating principle has really come into vogue in 97 when we started working with businesses in this area. It was kind of a brand new thing, and now it's becoming the operating framework for a lot of businesses. I think almost everybody agrees that it's a helpful framework where businesses voluntarily decide to take into account the environmental and social considerations. And then I think there's still a widespread misconception that a business corporation is only to make money and there should be no other considerations. So in that area, I think would be quite helpful. And I would say if you put Jim Kennedy in the equation here, we probably have 125 years of experience kind of just working with people as they organize businesses. And in our view, it would be a useful tool.
More follow-up. Other questions? Thank you very much. We have Representative Reed here, and I would ask you to be very brief, Representative Reed, because we are about to lose one of our crucial members of this committee, if you get my drift.
I can be very brief. Thank you, Madam Chair. Tobias Reed, State Representative, District 27. I had the honor of carrying this bill on the House floor and heard much of the testimony through your counterparts on the House side, just on the other side of the wall. I think it's a terrific bill and an important opportunity, and I urge your support.
Thank you. Any questions of Representative Reed? Okay, close the public hearing on House Bill 2826. Open work session on House Bill 2826. Senator Prezanski.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2826A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Prezanski has moved House Bill 2826A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Madam Chair, I'm going to oppose this quite simply. I think it can be done now and is being done, has been testified to, and I just don't see how adding fluffy PC words to statute accomplish anything.
Okay, other discussion?
Ditto. Like he said.
Ditto for Senator Beyer. Would you please call the roll? Please call the roll.
You're trying to save the time here.
That's a technical term.
Senator Chris, you need to vote.
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Byers?
No.
Aye. Approved. I will carry this bill. All right. Now we will open a public, and thank you very much for coming to testify on this. House Bill 2318. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2318 establishes that a tax appeal hearing must be assigned to a magistrate within 60 days after the end of a mediation session, absent a showing of good cause for a continuance. The current statute states that the hearing must be assigned within 60 days of the hearing being assigned to mediation. This would move the time period back to after the end of the mediation session.
Okay, welcome. Okay, Mr. Breithaupt, you are the only one signed up, so welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm Henry Breithaupt, the judge of the Oregon Tax Court, here to speak in favor of House Bill 2318. It is an attempt to change the statute so that the practice which in fact occurs in the mediation provisions in the tax court at the magistrate division, the statute will comply with the time that is needed to handle those cases. As your counsel explained, the statute as currently drafted really gives only a 60-day time period for a mediation to occur, and then it must be assigned to a magistrate for trial. In many, many cases, not all, but many cases that where you have any kind of complexity, 60 days is simply not enough time for parties to get their positions together and their representatives coordinated. And this bill would say the 60 days should run from the end of the mediation session, not the beginning. And that would permit the mediations that are occurring to fall within the statute without any problem.
Okay, and this, if you can show a good cause for a continuance, this doesn't have any upward limit.
No, that's right. In addition, if either party says, in addition to the 60 days after, we would like to, well, obviously if both parties came in and said, we're still talking, let us have more time, chances are they would get that. One party said we need some more time for good cause shown, a magistrate could extend the period beyond that 60-day provision.
Well, do you see any risk that this would just drag stuff out and out and out?
I personally don't. The Department of Revenue, I must say, is not opposed to this bill. They initially expressed some concern about that. Magistrate Tanner, the presiding magistrate, and I met with them. The court will adopt rules, and I would say that the practice of our magistrates, and that's where mediation occurs, is in the magistrate division, is such that I think the chance of anything being dragged out over the objection of either party is essentially zero.
Okay. Thank you, Judge Breithaupt. Senator Beyer.
Thank you. Well, I guess you said sometimes both parties may be still talking, but doesn't that mean they're still in mediation?
The mediation session itself may, oftentimes, is, I'll call it a semi-formal process, and there may be discussions occurring after that as the parties continue to work, and that would permit this to continue to occur without having it have to be assigned to be moved from mediation onto the trial docket.
Follow-up?
Please, Senator Beyer.
Thank you. So how long do the mediation sessions normally last? I mean, this is leaves them completely open-ended, so...
Well, the mediation itself would, again, it would depend on the nature of the proceeding. For example, when the valuation of the vegetable packing plants in the Willamette Valley was occurring. There, in terms of the number of properties and the complexity of the issues, that would be long. If it was a commercial property, one property, the mediation session itself might last half a day. But there might be follow-ups in terms of exchange of information and whatnot. So
in the case of the vegetable packing plants in the Willamette Valley, I'm familiar with those cases. In those cases, wasn't the money had already been paid that for the tax on those, so the processing plants were, quote-unquote, you know, the state already had the money, and they were working to get some of it back. So,
yes, Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, the property tax system is one in which, by operation of the due date for the bill and the lien provisions, the tax is typically paid well in advance of the dispute.
So the continuation of the question was, under this, with the property tax, normal property tax, if you dispute it and you win, you get 12% interest on your money until they give you your money back. Is that also the case here, or is the government going to be able to hold the money interest-free?
No. This is merely, excuse me, Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, this is one of the methods for dispute resolution. When the dispute is resolved, whether it's in a trial or mediation, if the taxpayer is entitled to a refund, that will come together with whatever interest the statute provides for.
Okay.
So that would be an incentive for the agency to hurry along, and then getting their money back would be incentive for the person to hurry along.
Well, yes, except for a lot of times 12% is as good as you can get anywhere, so it's a lot of money.
Well, and if I may address that, Madam Chairman.
Senator Beyer would like that comment deleted from the record.
No, that's a serious comment.
Anyway, please address.
Madam Chair, last session there was a bill that really tried to address the problem that those vegetable packing plant cases created. And as a result of that bill, the tax court has adopted rules, and the statute itself calls upon everyone to pay attention to the fact that time is money in these proceedings, and not to drag. And I would say that we have taken that. In those cases, both parties wanted to continue. We've taken seriously the direction from last session that these cases need to move. And this is merely designed to ease up on what is currently a statutory lock of 60 days from the time that it was assigned to mediation. So.
And you think that this will, letting off the limits a little bit, will result in more successful mediations?
Frankly, I think the record, and again, I speak for the magistrates here because that's where the mediations occur. It has been a very, very good record. I think on the margin it will allow perhaps a few more to be successful. But mostly what it will allow is it will take the time pressure off the parties and the magistrate from having to look and say, mediation's over, got to go to trial. It's really a...
That's actually what I meant. I mean, yeah. Do you see a scenario where you can avoid more trials?
Yes, I think if things... And again, I would also remind the members of the committee of this, and that is mediation is not ordered. It's in a sense a voluntary process. If you don't want to mediate, you don't mediate. Once you're in mediation, this allows the possibility of more flexible time frame.
Senator Pisanski.
Madam Chair, I think the end to that is that you have two willing parties that want to mediate. At some point, if one says, we've gone as far as we can go, then they can move into the trial scenario.
Exactly.
But this at least gives them the option. Okay. Everybody comfortable with this? Thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2318. Open a work session on House Bill 2318. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2318 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2318 to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. And with your expertise in the food processing industry, Senator Beyer, you can carry this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pisanski.
Just let you know, I believe a person from LC is here if you wanted to take up that other issue that Senator Walker had.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if you want to do that now or not.
Reopen the work session on
2093
and call up our legislative council guru to testify. And you have been in conversations with Senator Walker, so just introduce yourself and.
Okay.
Tell us what you have to say.
Okay. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I'm Marianne Milligan, senior senior staff attorney. I almost forgot there for a second. Legislative counsel. I have looked at House Bill 2093 and Gross and also 2092. And the relating clause in House Bill 2093 is relating to stays of proceedings. And as I understand what is being suggested, that would be fine under this relating clause. I think we can, it fits in. It would fit in.
The material that Senator Walker and Senator Przanski were interested in pursuing was to protect the custody rights of parents
yes.
who go to Iraq. And if we put an amendment in that subject matter in this relating clause of House Bill 2093, you're saying that that would fit in
yes,
the relating
it would.
Clause?
It okay. would not fit into House Bill, Angrost House Bill 2092, however. That's
okay. All right.
Point of clarification.
Senator Przanski.
Knowing that Senator Walker is going to want to jump on this pretty quick, just to make sure we're on the same page, because 2093 relates to stays of proceedings, I assume whatever would be considered as amendment would have to be dealing with a stay of a proceeding such as a custody proceeding?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and if it's in a court or an administrative, okay. but that's very broad, stays of proceedings.
Right.
And
okay.
Thank so you. it would be the proceeding itself rather than trying to deal with any substance, and that may actually be a good...
Counsel brought that to my attention. I think that's correct, especially when you're looking at this. So basically, we could have something that would either stay the proceeding or allow maybe for some type of temporary order until the person was back from being deployed, and then allowing them to at least have their day in court before a final decision would be made, not forcing them to actually start what we would consider their own proceeding to try to regain custody. At least that final decision could be put off until they were back, except in maybe some situations where the court ruled that it was in absolute best interest, you know, necessary. I mean, there's so many, as much as I agree with wanting to protect the rights, custodial rights of parents that are deployed, we have to leave flexibility with the court to some level, because there could be a scenario that we can't think of right now that would require that to be able to be done. And so I've told Senator Walker that, and I think that if she will allow me to have some input on that, we'll make sure that there is that flexibility.
Well, that's very good, and I think the key thing you said is just basically this removes the need for them to initiate their own proceeding.
Right.
So anything that's going to happen to their custodial rights will not occur until after they come home. And I think that's probably a good way to go, because it bypasses the whole substantive
right.
issue.
It's on the final, you know, to me it would be there could be temporary orders entered, but not a final permanent order mm-hmm. by the court.
Okay, well, you can look forward to two of my colleagues working with you further on this.
Chair,
Senator Cruz?
One question for Senator Przanski. I'm assuming all of this in the context of best interests, so.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that's why, I mean, this relating clause will actually preclude any change in the best interests of the child. Is that correct in that
as long as it's a chair Burdick members of committee, I'm sorry. It's as long as they're seeking a stay. And it's, yes, it would be a stay.
It would be a stay, and it would not be able to deal with the issue with the balancing of best interests of the child. Is that correct? Okay. Not expressing myself very well. Okay. Thank you very much for coming up, and we will hold on to House Bill 2093 for the moment. It will be rescheduled next week, and so we'll have to have something at least ready in concept by then. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2093.
Are you warm now? Are you warmer now?
Thank you.
Good. We do like to keep people warm in Senate Judiciary. Okay. Lost my agenda again. I'm wondering next. We will. Could you call Representative Krieger? We will go ahead and get started on House Bill 2345. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. A person who possesses a domestic animal that the person knows or has reason to know is abnormally dangerous is strictly liable for the harm caused by the animal. For all other domestic animals, an owner is liable for damages caused by an animal only if the owner was negligent in failing to prevent the harm. The Court of Appeals has ruled that in this context, negligence is determined by evaluating whether it was foreseeable that the dog might cause the injury. House Bill 2345A would establish that in an action arising from an injury caused by a dog, the plaintiff need not prove that the owner could have foreseen that the dog would cause the injury, and the owner may not assert as a defense that the dog bite was foreseeable. The bill would preserve any other defense that might be available to the owner, such as that the dog was provoked, and the bill clarifies that it expressly does not change the requirements for an award of punitive damages.
Okay, we have Linda Watkins from Yamhill County signed up. Representative Krieger had wanted to testify on this bill, but he is out of the building, so it's all up to you, Ms. Watkins.
Thank you. My name is Linda Watkins, and I am from Yamhill County, and I am very nervous. So,
oh, if you could just pull the mic a little closer to you, and we are just ordinary people, and we're not scary, so don't be nervous.
Okay, I'm testifying on this bill. I certainly don't negate the situation that gave rise to this bill. It was a horrendous accident. I can't even begin to imagine what this woman went through. But I think what happens with a lot of reactions to situations like this is that we tend to generalize, and in the process of generalizing, we forget that there are a number of other instances and situations where what you have written or what is written in this bill and what applies is going to have some repercussions beyond anything that you have considered. I work with rescue, animal rescue. Most of the groups that are in Oregon that work with animal rescue are nonprofit organizations. We own the animal. We rely upon volunteers to foster these animals, to rehabilitate them, and get them into appropriate homes. What the wording on this bill does is bring into question for many of us who owns these animals. We're getting strays from the shelters are calling us and saying, we have this great dog, we don't want to put it down, please help us. That's the kind of animal that we work with. We have no idea what the background on this animal is. We don't know if it's bitten somebody or not. We don't have a whole lot of history on these dogs that we have. If this dog does happen to bite somebody, as it stands right now with what they call the one bite rule, at least we can tell our fosters, okay, you know, it happened. And we've paid out money on animal bites in the last year. We pay it out anyway because that's what a responsible owner does. But with this bill, there would be the question of who is then liable? Is this the foster parent that's liable for this bite? Is it the 501c3 organization that owns the animal? Do we go back to the shelter or the owner that turned the animal over to us? We are volunteer. We depend on donations. We get contributions from pet stores, and vets discount their costs to us. And we don't have the money to buy liability insurance. For us to take an animal and ask somebody to foster that animal without any kind of a liability insurance or any kind of liability protection is totally irresponsible. Basically, what you would be doing, I think, is putting all of these nonprofit organizations out of business because, as I think most of you may know, if you've tried to work with an insurance company on getting liability coverage on a dog, it's virtually impossible to get, and if it is, the cost is just horrendous. Right now in Oregon, there are 155 rescue and shelter organizations. Any of those organizations work with anywhere from 25 to 30 people. Most of those people are doing fostering, and as I said, we're all volunteers. We don't get a dime out of it. All we do is put the money back into the dogs. I'm really concerned about this bill, number one, for the fosters and the benefit of that. We have a hard time finding foster families as it is with something like this. That's their first question is, what's the liability if this dog should happen to bite somebody? Now we have to tell them, we don't know until we go to court because that's what this law would do to us. You can't guarantee that a dog won't bite. The only way you can guarantee a dog is not going to bite is if that dog is already dead. There just are too many situations where that can't happen. I'm concerned about this for the implications for humane societies, for animal shelters. If I walk into an animal shelter and I'm looking at dogs and the dog bites me, who's liable for that bite? There's also a question that I didn't even really get into heavily on this, which is what kind of a bite is actionable? What this woman experienced with the law that or the situation that brought this on was a horrible thing. And I think that the people that own that dog, I can't imagine that they wouldn't have tried to pay for it or try to help. It's just horrible. But I work with Australian cattle dogs, herding dogs, and they nip. And that's usually when they're nipping heels or something like that. Well, we paid out $500 on one of those bites last year that was a nip. Not because it was a life-threatening situation, but because the person who was nipped ended up, he was an elderly man, he was a mean man, he went to the hospital, he had a tetanus shot, he had antibiotics, and by the time he was done with an emergency room, it was $500. That's five dogs that died.
You said that you don't have insurance, so how do you pay these claims?
We depend on donations. When we have the dogs that we work with, we do charge adoption fees on these dogs. It's anywhere from $150 to $200. We do get donations privately from people that just... I've spent about 20 hours on the road this week helping out, moving dogs around and helping people. One guy had some puppies he wanted to get rid of, and then he decided he wanted them back, and I helped him get them back. He gave me $75 for thank you for helping. We get private donations that way. We're very fortunate with food. We work with Petco. They donate all the broken bags and food to us. Actually, they have tremendous number of rescues that they do donate to, and we're one of them. Petco also, when you go into those stores and they do the fundraisers that they're doing at Christmas time and, you know, add a dollar or add $5 to your bill, we're one of the recipient groups that gets money out of that. So we do get donations and contributions and a few small grants from other organizations.
Thank you. Question, Senator Kozanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering what your position would be if the committee decided to modify this bill and had some type of an exemption for nonprofits or some type of adoption groups.
Yeah. That's and I didn't finish what I should have finished, which is that I'm not totally against the bill, but I would like to see some consideration for that and some thought put into how maybe some of those things could be protected, and also that I am more than happy to work with it. The reason that nobody else is here is because we didn't find out about this until about 4 days ago. The director for the group that I work with is right now in Corvallis cleaning kennels at Heartland Humane Society for the 83 dogs that were seized over there. So
the current law that we have now is that if you have reason to believe your dog is going to bite and then he bites, then you're on the hook. That hasn't been a problem for you?
No, and that's not a problem for us. Generally, if we get a dog that does one bite, it's registered, it's filed, like with the one with the $500 that we paid out, obviously the guy reported him to the county too. So the dog is on record in that county as having bitten. We know that dog is bitten. When we adopt that dog out, and we did adopt that dog out, we made certain that the owners knew, and the new owners knew and understood that that dog did have a bite record. Any subsequent bites from that dog would cause some real problems for everybody involved. And we also made sure that that dog went into a situation where the odds and chances of another bite occurring were minimized. You know, that's not a dog that we'd adopt out to a family with five small children.
Okay.
So.
All right. Well, thank you for coming to testify. Are there any other questions?
It's a question more for us. Looking at where the bill originated, it seems like it came out of House Judiciary during the interim. So, and your statement that Representative Krueger wanted to testify, it seems to me that maybe some of the scenarios, I don't know if they were discussed on the House side or not, but we should maybe check in with him to see if he would be willing to
work with that. Were some terrible scenarios that led to this bill, and I think Representative Krueger would be more than happy to
participate. He does have a copy of this testimony. I have been in contact with his office.
Okay.
So,
You testify in the House?
I did not. We we literally, most of the rescue community knew nothing about this bill until it was actually on Channel 2 News. I saw it the other night and went, ah! You know, and so
you
that's...
You work on our communication, yeah. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just looking at the original bill versus the amended bill, and the original bill just speaks of medical expenses, and that seems more reasonable to me, unless I don't understand in the amended bill, when you're talking about the... that caused the action, and then it speaks of 31730 about the punitive damages. So does this bill allow for non-economic damages as in the amended version, and or is it just the economic damages? And I think it's saying it doesn't just I guess let me ask that question first.
Thank you, Senator Beyer. Madam Chair, I do believe it would allow for non-economic. To the extent you're entitled to non-economic damages for a negligence action arounding out of a dog bite, you wouldn't have to prove foreseeability. So,
Say that again, counsel.
To the extent that you are allowed non-economic damages in a negligence action arising out of a dog bite, this wouldn't change that fact that you're entitled to non-economic damages. What it would change is you wouldn't have to prove foreseeability anymore. That big change is that the punitive damages carve-out was an attempt to make sure that to the extent foreseeability is one of the factors that might come into an award of punitive damages, you would still have to prove foreseeability. So the short answer is, I think, yes, you could get non-economic damages and you wouldn't have to prove foreseeability to the extent you're already entitled to non-economic damages.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Please, Senator Barr.
Thank you. I'm looking at 31730, and in that statute, you have to prove by clear and convincing evidence in order to get punitive damages, but it's a lesser level of proof to get to the non-economic or economic damages under this bill, isn't it?
Correct. It would be preponderance of evidence, just a typical negligence case. Right.
You also were counsel on the House side.
I was.
Was there any discussion of having a different, the original bill applied only to medical expenses, which is actual damages, I think we've included, and having the old standard apply to non-economic damages?
Correct. As it was originally drafted, it only applied to medical expenses, but not. So if you lost work, it wouldn't apply to that. Future earning capacity, it wouldn't apply to that. Pain and suffering. I think it was even narrower than what we would consider economic damages. So if you missed work for 2 weeks, that wouldn't have been covered.
Wouldn't it be basically out of pocket? I mean, stuff that you actually had to pay for.
Just medical, though. Just medical expenses.
But I would think that that missed work, if you could quantify that, that would be in the category of economic damages.
Correct. But the way it was originally drafted, it said, in any action for medical expenses. So it wasn't. It didn't differentiate by economic or non-economic. It just said, for medical expenses only, you don't have to prove foreseeability. Eventually, it was amended to say, for all, essentially, economic for any damages that you can get other than punitive damages.
So if you had, was there any discussion of having this looser standard only apply to not just medical but maybe lost work, in other words, actual economic damages, broader economic damages, and saving the old standard for non-economic and punitive?
Madam Chair, I think at the first hearing there was some testimony about limiting it to medical, and there was some discussion about whether that was, you know, good policy. But I don't think they ever said, well, maybe we could have this middle ground of just economic damages and not non-economic damages. They just decided in the end to go with damages other than punitives.
Okay. Thank you.
Real quick, the idea of doing some kind of exemption or looking at some way of modifying this would, you know, be a really big help. I think that part of it needs to be done. I think that dog owners need to take responsibility for what they're doing. But in the situation that we're looking at, you know, it's virtually impossible to get liability insurance.
But it sounds to me like your current practices, if this were limited, this particular criterion were limited to medical out-of-pocket, it sounds like you do that anyway.
Yeah, but Madam Chair, if I could, I mean, one of the things I'm hearing is for the fostering, calling parents that are doing this work, it seems like they need some clarification because, I mean, we fostered through our, lack of better terms, Humane Society, the public agency, some cats, and just because they needed the help and they needed to know about the situation. And the question is, are you going to saddle those individuals that are going to foster? Mm-hmm. And a lot of these dogs are dogs, let's call them at risk, who are coming out of very high stressful environments that are going to maybe have a tendency to maybe not be as subtle and balanced. And so are you going to allow for that foster person to shoulder this without some other fault, in the sense of where they actually help provoke or do something that they could be held accountable for, as compared to the dog just reacting to the situation that they're transitioning from? So good. I think that's the other part of this.
That's a tough one.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. You have anything to add to that?
Well, I could talk for 2 hours about this. But
Senator Cruz, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The person who brought this to our attention is a constituent of mine and Representative Krieger's, and I would be interested to hear from the committee, from the House committee, why they went from the bill that I knew was drafted, because these people were seeking, I mean, the remedy they were seeking was medical. I mean, that's what they wanted. And it's fairly clear and concise, the original bill. I would like to hear from somebody on that committee how they morphed into where they got to.
I'll bring this up with Representative McPherson.
I do have one comment. You were asking me about, it seems like we are already paying out the medical on these. And frankly, on the bill that I was, the situation that I was telling you about, the gentleman who was bitten, or nipped actually, was so upset about it that he was harassing our foster mom. He was down there 3 days a week, harassing her. He had called the police, I think in 3 days he had called the police on her 4 times, when every time she took the dog out to go to the bathroom, he called to tell him that the dog was outside. We finally paid that bill just to make him leave her alone, because the foster mom was so distressed. We lost our foster mom on that one. She was a very good foster mother, and we lost her on that because she just couldn't deal with it. So $500, we scraped it up, we did it. $500 is one thing to be willing to do. God forbid we should ever have to look at the kind of medical bills that, you know, we're talking about with this one. I think most of us in the foster world would find a way to raise the money to help with something like that. But to be legally liable for it would just terrify. It would scare off any foster families we could look at. And I know that for a fact. I wouldn't do it.
Thank you. Any other comments? OK.
Counsel?
I can just add one thing about, so there's two major changes in the original bill as originally drafted and what we ended up with. One of them is the difference between the damages, and I think that was just policy decision, and you can talk to Representative McPherson. The other one, the way the bill was originally drafted, it only talked about the owner of the dog may not assert as a defense foreseeability, and it's not entirely accurate to think of it that way because it's something that the plaintiff would have to prove. So you'd have to prove that it was not foreseeable. So that's why it looks a little bit more complicated, but it's a little bit more accurate to say that the plaintiff need not prove that the dog could foresee that the owner of the dog could foresee that the dog would cause an injury, and they included the part about it not being a defense either. So that was the explanation for that change. And then there's the damages change, which is just a policy decision.
Seems like such a simple little subject, and it gets very complicated very quick. Thank you for coming. We're going to hang on to this for a while. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2345. We got one quick one left. Switch councils here. I think it's quick anyway. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 2741. Council.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. House Bill 2741 relates to the authority of certain persons to conduct investigations. ORS 146.090 to 146.125 gives district attorneys and medical examiners joint responsibility to conduct human death investigations. Within this investigative authority is, in part, the power to control a crime scene, to enter and secure premises, and to take possession of certain evidence or personal property. A primary concern is the preservation of any potentially relevant evidence in the event that the death, and only certain types of deaths require investigations, but in the event that the death actually resulted from a crime. In cases where there is a physical injury, but not death, a different statutory section controls the investigations. ORS 146.730 gives only the medical examiner, not any district attorney, the authority to investigate if the injury occurred under, quote, suspicious or unknown circumstances, close quote, and involved a physical injury caused by a knife, gun, pistol, or other deadly weapon. The term deadly weapon is defined in Oregon law as any instrument, article, or substance specifically designed for and presently capable of causing death or serious physical injury. The scope of this investigative authority for injuries, then, is the same as for death investigations. House Bill 2741 addresses two general concerns with the present law relating to investigations. The first concern is that only the medical examiner and not the district attorney presently has the authority to conduct injury investigations, again, anything that's just short of death. House Bill 2741 amends this and allows the district attorney or, of course, the medical examiner to conduct these injury investigations. The concern is that if a crime occurred, there is likely evidence that should be preserved, just as there is in cases that resulted in death. The medical examiner's concern in injury cases would be to save the victim and not to preserve evidence. The second concern is that existing law is not broad enough to cover all suspicious injuries. Many crimes or assaults happen through the use of items that are not deadly weapons, such as, for example, hands or rocks, pipes, screwdrivers. Those are not instruments designed for causing death. House Bill 2741 broadens the scope of ORS 146 to include such circumstances. Specifically, it does a couple of things. One, it adds the phrase to deadly weapon, it changes it to dangerous or deadly weapon. The term dangerous weapon is broader than deadly weapon, and it includes any weapon, device, instrument, material, or substance which, under the circumstances in which it is used, attempted to be used, or threatened to be used, is readily capable of causing death or serious physical injury. So that encompasses many more items that are commonly used in these fights. House Bill 2741 also expands this investigative authority to include not just physical injuries involving death or dangerous weapons, but also any serious physical injury, which is defined in Oregon law as a physical injury which creates a substantial risk of death or which causes serious and protracted disfigurement, protracted impairment of health, or protracted loss or impairment of the function of any bodily organ.
Okay. We have Mr. Sparks from the Multnomah County DA. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. I'm here to address House Bill 2741. I'm Chuck Sparks with the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. I am here to add just briefly to the complete summary that committee counsel has already given. very thorough. He's addressed, I think, all relevant points. But briefly, the current regime under Chapter 146, which allows the district attorney to engage in criminal investigations relating to suspicious or uncertain deaths, where we just don't know what happened, does not currently extend to the collateral situation involving a serious injury where you may have someone who, due to the modern abilities of medicine, who's pulled back from the brink of death, who isn't currently able to tell us how they got hurt, their situation currently can't be fully examined for potential crimes if it's not apparent on the face that there are crimes involved. In other words, it's just a suspicious situation, and some examples would include you have somebody who has a gunshot wound. They're not dead. It may be self-inflicted. It may be a suicide attempt, or it may be that somebody shot them. But you don't know, and obviously you want to find out. Another example from the House side hearing brought up by one of the members' personal experience was somebody had was found hanging. And it was unclear whether it was a suicide attempt or not. They were cut down, thankfully, before they were dead. But the situation needed to be investigated, and yet there was no indication, suicide or not, clearly either way. Motor vehicle accidents are another example. They don't really come to mind when you think of this situation, but oftentimes law enforcement will come upon a situation where you've got some people who are very seriously hurt. They're not going to be able to talk about what happened, and yet you may have some very serious issues of criminal liability, and yet no probable cause at that point to, for example, seize vehicles because nobody's died. If somebody dies, then under Chapter 146, the district attorney has the authority to do a competent investigation, but if it's injury short of death, we don't. The medical examiner has that authority, but the medical examiner, and I spoke with Dr. Gunson yesterday, Dr. Karen Gunson, who is the medical examiner for the state of Oregon, she first of all, does not object to the district attorney's receiving this authority, but she confirmed what was common knowledge, and that is the medical examiner does not engage in active investigation of suspicious injuries. What they will typically do is provide a consultation so that a doctor may call and say, I'm going to email you some photos, or would you mind coming and taking a look at these injuries and giving me your opinion? But the medical examiner's office is not equipped to seize and store evidence to do the follow-up investigation that's necessary in a criminal circumstance. So it would the bill would enlarge the authority to include the district attorney now, in addition to the medical examiner, in cases of injuries, suspicious injuries. It would expand the types of injuries to include injuries inflicted by weapons other than knives or guns, which stands to reason there are a lot of other things out there that people use to hurt each other, including cars and the array of instruments that counsel for the committee has described. And finally, it would include serious injury inflicted without weapons, because obviously that may well be a situation more extreme than one where you have mere physical injury inflicted with a weapon. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we want a situation where someone may have been battered by hand to be investigated just as thoroughly as it would be anything with a weapon.
And I presume, given the budget constraints that are throughout the criminal justice system, that you wouldn't just be using this authority to do blanket investigations unless you had some other reason.
Madam Chair, we currently, yes, you're exactly right. We're not looking to expand and create new fields of investigation. What we're looking to do is deal with those circumstances. They're not extremely common, but they're common enough to be of a concern. Where an example, I supervise the vehicle homicide and assault investigative team, so we send lawyers out in the middle of the night to assist law enforcement in obtaining search warrants. It's not uncommon to have a situation where you just don't know what happened, and you don't know if there's criminal liability, and nobody has died, and so you don't have the authority to gather evidence which will lead to the truth of the matter later on. So really, all this does, because evidence can exonerate as well as inculpate, and you may have someone who looks terribly guilty, and I'll give you an example. About 3 weeks.
You'll have to hurry because we're running out of time.
Well, then I won't give it. I'll just answer questions.
Senator Barr.
Thank you. So is the medical examiner the same as the crime lab? I mean, is that the one and the same? I mean, because it seems to me like the crime lab should be the one that is there, not necessarily the medical examiner or the district attorney. It should be the crime lab people.
Different. Madam Chair, Vice Chair Beyer, and members of the committee, the crime lab is a laboratory, and they will send occasionally people out to conduct investigations, but at the direction of the district attorney, because under Oregon law, the district attorney is the law enforcement officer that organizes and directs all law enforcement investigations.
Within the county.
Within
the county.
Within the county. That's exactly right, Senator Przanski. So that the crime lab has an evidentiary gathering and interpretation role, but they do not investigate
We don't have CSI units. It's just amazing how many people out, even juries now, they're basically looking for this scientific evidence that they see on TV that's turned around in 60 seconds to get a conviction.
That's so true.
Works for me. Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Burdick.
I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2741. I see somebody in the back of the room who just looks bored as crazy. So I'll give you a chance to come up if you want, Amy.
Hi, Senator Burdick. No, I'm just here to see if there are any questions.
Okay. All right. Open a work session on House Bill 2741. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chairman, House Bill 2741 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2741 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Przanski, would you like to carry? Thank you. Okay, committee, we are adjourned.